Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 24. I'm going to cover the first 28 verses. I'm going to call this Abraham's servant finds Rebekah in Padan Aram. Now, context is this. In chapter 23, we read about Sarah's death and burial. So, unfortunately, Sarah did not get to see the marriage of her son Isaac. We now start in chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. Now, Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh. Now, Abraham was old. He's 140 years old. How is that calculated? Well, Abraham was 100 when Isaac was born, we know. Isaac was 40 when he married Rebekah. We know that from Genesis 25, verse 20, the next chapter. Isaac was 40 years old when he took his wife Rebekah. You add 100 plus 40. And Abraham was old, 140, advanced in age. The Lord had blessed Abraham in every way, with temporal blessings and spiritual blessings. His temporal blessings included a long life, great honor, children, Isaac, material riches. But he still doesn't have a wife for his son. And this is important because the promise to Abraham of a seed that was going to be as numerous as the sand by the seashore and as the stars in the sky, all that promise from God hinged on whether his son Isaac could produce descendants. And he can't do that without a wife. So this is very important here. So he goes to his servant to find a wife for Isaac. Now, his servant says is the oldest of his household, so that means it's probably Eliezer of Damascus, who we read about in Genesis 15, 2 through 3, at the time of the cutting of the covenant, which is somewhere between Abraham's 75th and 85th year. We don't know exactly where, but since he is now 140, that was a long time ago. And Eliezer's still there. Genesis 15, verses 2 through 3, Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? So Eliezer was the heir, Abraham's heir, before Isaac was born. So he was a trusted servant. We don't know that the servant that was sent to get Isaac was Eliezer for certain. It's just a probability. As the NIV Study Bible says, quote, he must have lived with him 50 years and upwards. One may trace him near 60 years in Abraham's family. And, excuse me, this is John Gill, not NIV Study Bible. He must have lived with him 50 years and upwards. One may trace him near 60 years in Abraham's family, and it is highly probable he lived much longer. He was his servant when he had the vision between the pieces in Genesis 15:2, and then he was the steward of his house. So we're going to assume this is Eliezer, although we don't know it. Now, a question arises here. Why didn't Abraham go to Syria, Padan Aram, to find a wife himself for Isaac? Well, here are some options for that. He could have just been too old, as Jameson Fawcett Brown says, 140 years old. And Jameson Fawcett Brown also adds this interesting fact. As heir of the promise, he couldn't even make a temporary visit back home. What would have happened if he had died while he was back in Syria? Wouldn't have been too good. Now, verse 2 ends up with this strange exhortation for Eliezer. Abraham asked him to please place your hand under my thigh. Now, there's some options for what this meant. John Gill and Adam Clark say this is the standard way of swearing in that culture. I don't know that culture, so I don't doubt that to be true. Some people speculated it could be that Abraham wanted Eliezer to place Eliezer's hand close to Abraham's organ of procreation because the oath of many descendants as the stars of the sky was related to the continuation of Abraham's line through Isaac. That's the NIV Study Bible's suggestion. And so that's why Eliezer is supposed to put his hand on Abraham's thigh. It could be it refers to the covenant of circumcision because his hand is close to Abraham's organ of procreation, and that might be related to circumcision because Abraham's organ of procreation was circumcised. John Gill disagrees with this and says it's not likely. But I think that's reasonable speculation as why the hand was placed there. It was with reference to that promise of progeny that was given by God to Abraham. Now, it doesn't say whether the hand was placed under the thigh, on the outside of the leg, or the inside of the leg. We don't know. We go to verse 3 and 4 in Genesis 24. Abraham continues, speaking to Eliezer, "And I, Abraham, will make you, Eliezer, swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I live, but you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." Swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth. That's a pretty majestic title. It's used in an oath, and so Abraham's very formal here. He used a similar oath when he swore to the king of Sodom when the king of Sodom tried to give him some spoils, because some riches, some wealth, because Abraham had beaten back the four kings of Mesopotamia who had attacked the Sodom and the other cities down there of the plain, those five cities. This is in Genesis 14. Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." So these are very majestic titles. God of heaven and God of earth, that means he's God of everything. He said to Eliezer, "You're not going to get away from my son from the daughters of the Canaanites." As John Gill pointed out, the Canaanites were pagans. They were idolaters. They were degenerates. Abraham didn't want Isaac to marry one, which is understandable. So Abraham tells Eliezer to go to my country, to Abraham's country, and to my relatives. Well, what was my country? Well, that's Mesopotamia, Upper Mesopotamia, more precisely Nahor or Haran, which is in Syria, right to the north and east of Israel. Now, we're going to get into the problem of Nahor in just a minute. It's unclear whether there were two cities there. There was Haran, which is still there today. It was a small village today, and then Nahor, which is gone, but it was in the general vicinity of Haran, and it's not exactly sure which city that Eliezer was going to go to. I'm going to assume Nahor, but it's not clear, as I'll show you why in just a minute. But we know it's in Padam Aram, which is what they called Syria back then. Aram, of course, is Syria, A-R-A-M. Abraham says he wants Eliezer to go to his relatives. You remember Abraham's relatives? First of all, Nahor had a brother called Nahor, and that's where this little village got its name of Nahor. Genesis 22:29 came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, "Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor." Nahor was the younger brother of Abraham. He's now living at the town of Nahor, probably. Genesis 24:10. In a few verses, we'll see Eliezer the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. So that sounds like Nahor is a city there in Mesopotamia, which is upper Mesopotamia, Syria. But John Gill says the city of Nahor is Haran, because if you take Nahor as a person and not as a town there to the city of Nahor, well, Nahor's city was Haran because that's where he lived. So that's why it's not clear exactly where Eliezer's heading to. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible, instead of translating it the city of Nahor, as the New American Standard Bible does, translates it this way: he went to Aram Naharaim, to Nahor's town. Well, Nahor's town could very well be Haran, not the town of Nahor. The Coleman Christian Study Bible uses Aram Naharaim, which means highland between two rivers. That name is used sometimes. Sometimes the area is Padam Aram. Sometimes it's just called Aram. Sometimes it's called the land of Abraham's relatives. Sometimes it's just called Haran by itself. That's the area where the Euphrates River, as it is moving from southeast to northwest, all of a sudden takes a strong northward turn, then actually hooks back a little bit going east, and then continues on up into the Taurus Mountains. And that little elbow there, that little crook of the Euphrates River, is what we're talking about here. That's where Abraham lived when he lived in Haran before he went to Shechem in the Promised Land. So that's where he's telling his servant Eliezer to go. So Eliezer is to go to the city of Nahor, which is either a city called Nahor, is the city of the person Nahor, which is Haran. He's supposed to go there and go to his relatives. Now, the relative he's going to end up dealing with is Rebekah's brother Laban. Now, when Laban was young, he lived in Nahor's town, the town of Nahor, assuming that's a different town. Genesis 28:10, Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. That's later. If he used to live in Nahor, he moved to Haran later. In the Genesis 29:4, Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." So that's probably spending too much time on that, but just for the sake of completeness, we mention it. Now, these relatives of Abraham that Eliezer was going to see, they were idolaters too, if you recall. They weren't exactly God-fearers or worshipers of Yahweh, so what's the advantage of getting a wife from there? It's an interesting question. John Gill says, well, that might be true that they were idolaters, but they also worshipped the true God along with their idols, and the Canaanites didn't do that. I don't know how John Gill knows that. Also, think about this. A woman could be taken from this pagan environment of Haran and taught to worship the true God. A Canaanite woman could not be so taught. She would be constantly tempted by her friends and neighbors, whereas a foreigner could hold on to her gods that she brought from Padan Aram. Also, another reason why Abraham didn't want Eliezer to take a wife from amongst the Canaanites was because the Canaanites were under a curse of God. Genesis 9:25, so he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers. That was Noah speaking the famous curse over Canaan, who was the son of his son Ham. So why would Abraham want to take a wife for Isaac from there? It's understandable. We go now to Genesis 24, verses 5 through 9. The servant said to him, Eliezer said to Abraham, suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came? Then Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Now, this question that Eliezer asked Abraham, suppose the woman is not willing to follow me back. Well, that's quite understandable. In fact, it's quite probable that most women in Nahor or Haran, wherever they were, wouldn't want to go back to a strange land, as John Gill points out. Now, why did Eliezer ask Abraham, should I take Isaac, your son, back to Syria, back to Aram? Why would he even bring that up? He knew of the land promised to Abraham. He probably figured that Abraham didn't want Isaac to go back to Haran because of the promise that Abraham was going to inherit all that land there through his descendants. And so he asked Abraham probably just to make sure, probably thinking, Abraham, you don't want me to take Isaac back there, back to Haran. Am I correct? And Abraham said, yes, don't take my son back there. So now the back, should I take your son back to the land from where you came? That sounds like Isaac had been there before. Actually, that's not true. Isaac had never been in Haran. So why did the servant ask, should Isaac be taken back? Well, because he's looking at it from the point of view of Abraham's former position, back to your former land, not Isaac's former place of position. John Gill says it's because Isaac's in the loins of Abraham, but I think that's not the way to explain it. Abraham in verse 7 says, God took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth. There's always a question there when he mentions the land of his birth. He was born in Ur, and he moved from Ur to Haran, then Haran to Shechem, to the promised land. But I don't see how Haran is a viable option here because Abraham wasn't born in Haran. So he's talking about Ur, God who took me from Ur of the Chaldees down there near the Persian Gulf, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your descendants I will give this land. Abraham is referring to Genesis 12, verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, and this Genesis 12 is when Abraham has not gotten to the promised land yet, he's still in Haran. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. That's what he's referring to. Abraham repeats that promise to explain to Eliezer why Isaac should not be taken to Haran. He's worried that Haran will swallow up Isaac, and Isaac will never return to the promised land. And that, of course, would destroy God's promise to Abraham concerning that land. Abraham tells Eliezer that God's angel, will go before you. Now, of course, that could be just an ordinary created angel, or it could be the angel of the Lord, Jesus, the same angel of the Lord that sprung up and talked to Hagar when she was dying of thirst in the wilderness near Shur, the wilderness of Shur, Genesis 16, the same angel of the Lord that shows up everywhere, actually, in the Old Testament. Now, a problem might arise here. Why does Abraham say, if the woman is not willing, in verse 8? He says, but if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath, Eliezer. You'll be free if the woman is not willing to follow you. But he just said the angel of God is going to go before Eliezer. Why would he think the woman would refuse? Well, notice that Abraham merely said that the angel of the Lord was to go before Eliezer to go to Haran. He didn't say that the angel of the Lord was going to make Rebekah come back. There was no such promise. And John Gill points out that this is a prayer or a wish. in his view, I'm not sure about that, but he says it's just a wish that the angel of God would go before him. It doesn't sound like that to me. He says, sounds to me like he's saying the angel of God is going to go. I don't know how Abraham knew that, but he seems pretty confident to me. But maybe he's not. Maybe he's just saying, I hope so, that the angel will precede you. But anyway, go, Eliezer. I'm trusting you. I'm trusting God. Find a wife for Isaac. Genesis 24, verses 10 through 11 says this. Then the servant, that's Eliezer probably, took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. Now, 10 camels. Camels were not widely used during Abraham's time. They were not widely used until much later. But the NIV Study Bible points out occasionally they were domesticated during the patriarchal period, and archaeology has proven that, so that's not a problem with the accuracy of the text. Now, these camels were loaded with good things, as the NASB has it, good things. 10 camels loaded with good things. That's a pretty good bride price. So Abraham's not sparing any expense to, I hate to put it this way, but to purchase a bride for Isaac. They went to Mesopotamia. That's how you translate Aram, Naharaim, Aram of the two rivers of the highland between the two rivers. That part of Syria, which lay between the Tigris and Euphrates River, the northern part of what the Greeks later called Mesopotamia. The later Greeks called it Mesopotamia, and that's why some translations call it Mesopotamia. But actually, the Hebrew is Aram Naharaim, Aram of the two rivers. Now, this city of Nahor, which is where I'm assuming that Eliezer's heading for, is located in the Haran district. BibleAtlas.org has no map for it, so again, this is an iffy city, because Nahor could be referring to the person, not to the town here, and so the city of Nahor could be Haran, as I've already said. However, the NIV Study Bible points out that the Hebrew for Nahor is spelled differently when it refers to a person, Abraham's brother, than when it refers to the town. So that makes me think it's a town. So that's what we're going to go with. It was ruled by an Amorite prince in the 18th century BC in the 1700s. We are now probably in the 19th century BC. So that's pretty close. The moon god was worshipped there just as at Ur. Haran is famous for the moon god. Same as Ur was famous for worshiping the moon god. Sin, I think her name was. It was a flourishing caravan city in the 19th century BC. This is, of course, at the time we're talking about, it's actually mentioned on the Mari tablets excavated in 1933 at Mari on the Euphrates, which if you look at the map, is just right down river a little ways from Haran. Haran is not actually on the Euphrates. You're heading northwest on the Euphrates, and you hit a river called the Balik, where Balik River intersects in the Euphrates. You go down that river a little ways, and then you hit Haran. And, of course, Nahor is very close to Haran. But anyway, that explains the translation Mesopotamia in the NASB. So Eliezer made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time. Camels kneel. Why do they kneel? Well, so you can get the stuff off their back and so they can rest. They've been walking across the desert. Now, this well, a well is where strangers would go, a logical place for them to go. They could station themselves at wells to get information. They could learn all the news of the place from the women who were drawing water there. The women would come in the morning and the evening when it was cool. And right now, it's in the evening time. Verse 11 says that Eliezer shows up in the evening. And so it's a logical time for women to be there. And that's what he wants to do. He wants to find women. You know, he wants to find somebody to marry Isaac. So he goes where the women are. And of course, it was customary for women to draw water for their households. So he goes there for two reasons. One, to get news, find out things. And also, because there are women there, he wants to maybe find a wife for Isaac. We go to Genesis 24, verses 12 through 14. He, the servant, said, Eliezer, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today. He's praying. And show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. Now, notice that Eliezer is praying to Yahweh, Lord Yahweh, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham. So as John Gill says, no doubt Abraham's God was Eliezer's God also. Here's a good application point here. When one is given a divine task, perhaps you ought to pray before attempting to accomplish it. Eliezer was a godly man. He said, this is very important. I mean, he's trying to find an heir to keep God's promise going, trying to find a wife to marry the heir of the promise so that the promise would continue. So this is a big deal. And so he prays. And not only does he pray, he asks for a sign. I'm looking for a girl that's going to give me water and my camels to water. Now, this idea of asking for a sign, a lot of people choke at that. I remember when I was in the charismatic movement back in the late 60s, early 70s at the University of South Carolina, and I was losing my faith, and it had been 2 years that I've been struggling mightily not to lose my faith, and I was in a horrible intellectual turmoil, and I'd ask God, please, Lord, the Bible's full of miracles, and yet my atheist father doesn't believe in miracles, and nobody believes in miracles, and I have trouble believing that there are miracles in the Bible, and so please show me that miracles exist. Well, I never had any idea that he would actually show me a miracle. I was asking to show me that miracles exist, but I mean, he actually showed me one. Somebody, to make a long story short, somebody prayed for my leg and it grew out in the thin air. And I don't care what any cessationist says, you're not going to tell me I was wrong about that. And back then, if you mentioned to a non-charismatic that God had done a sign, the immediate thing you could say, the Jews seek for a sign, like the Gentiles seek for wisdom, and it's wrong to seek for a sign. You're testing God. I heard that over and over again. Well, I wasn't biblically sophisticated back then, but if I had known the Bible as well as I do now, I would have said, well, now, wait a minute. Here, Eliezer asked for a sign from Yahweh, and Yahweh gave it to him. Rebekah went up and offered to feed his camels, to give water to his camels. That was a sign, and he used that sign. How about the Virgin Mary? She had angels appear to her when she had to face the difficulties of bearing the Messiah. How about Paul in the Antonia fortress after the third journey when he was arrested by the Roman military official there to keep him from getting torn apart by the mob, and he was imprisoned. He was by himself. He had a heavenly vision, and God told him to be obedient to that heavenly vision. How about the Macedonian call? Paul had a dream to cross from Asia to Europe when he was in Troas trying to decide where to go. Big decisions. God gives signs. How about Gideon's fleece? That's a famous sign because Gideon had a terrible situation there. He was 300 people fighting all those Midianites. How about John's gospel? The first seven miracles that are done in God's gospels are by all the big shot commentators. They're called seven signs, the seven signs of John. John said all these things were not done in a corner that you might believe. Well, why did Jesus do all the miracles? For signs, signposts to point you to heaven. There ain't nothing wrong with signs, folks. The problem is when you ask for signs in ordinary circumstances, like, I need a sign. Should I eat today? I need a sign. Should I go to work today? I need a sign. Do I need to get out of bed today? Well, of course, that's stupid. But when the chips are down and people are in trouble, ask for God to show himself big to you. He'll do it. And don't let anybody tell you, well, you're just testing God. You might be testing God, but there are lots of times in here in the Bible where people ask for signs that weren't testing for God, that weren't testing God, and Eliezer here was not testing God. There was also natural wisdom in this sign, because if a girl offered to water his camels as well as him, that would show that she was careful and industrious, she was humane and courteous, and she was humble. She would do the meanest task. Here's what Adam Clark says, quoting Dr. Dodd. The conduct of the servant, says Dr. Dodd, appears no less pious than rational. By supplicating for a sign, he acknowledges God to be the greatest superintendent and director of the universe, and of that event in particular. And at the same time, by asking a natural sign, such as betokened humanity, condescension, and other qualities which promised a discreet and virtuous wife, he puts his prayer upon such a discreet, rational footing as to be a proper example for all to imitate who would not tempt the providence of God by expecting extraordinary signs to be given them for the determination of cases which they are capable of deciding by a proper use of their rational faculties. Now, he says in fancy terminology what I just said. If you can use your head to know that you need to eat today, you don't need a sign. That's your rational faculties. But if you're in a situation where your mind is not capable of figuring out what to do, ask God to show you something. Nothing wrong with that. Now think of the pressure, I've already mentioned this, that Eliezer was under. His actions determine the outcome of the seed promised to Abraham. That justifies him asking for a sign. Now in verse 14, if the sign would be answered, Eliezer says to God, by this I will know that you, the Lord, have shown loving kindness to my master. And that loving kindness is not just in general. Most probably is probably referring to the covenant promises of a seed, descendants, land, offspring, and blessing. NIV Study Bible points that out, and I think they're right. Genesis 24:15, before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. Now, there's a lot of names mentioned here. I'm going to give you Abraham's family. You're probably not going to remember, but just to show you that it's all in there in the scriptures, you can dig it out. The genealogy is complicated, as John Gill says, but nonetheless, here it is. You got Abraham, and Abraham had two brothers. One was Haran, the older brother, and he had a younger brother named Nahor. Now, his older brother Haran had a daughter named Milcah, so that's Abraham's niece, and it was Nahor's niece. Well, Nahor married Milcah. So younger brother Nahor marries older brother Haran's daughter Milcah, so Nahor married his niece, and Abraham's niece too. All right, so Nahor and Milcah then have a son called Bethuel, and Bethuel has Rebekah. Now, if you look at all this, this makes Rebekah Abraham's grandniece. So Isaac's wife was Abraham's grandniece, as the NIV Study Bible puts it. This is seen in verse 48 of Genesis 24, which we won't get to in this audio. And I bowed low. This is Eliezer recounting what had happened. He says, I bowed low and worshiped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. In the NIV, says the daughter of my master's brother. What he's talking about is the master's brother is Nahor, and the daughter means the descendant, the granddaughter Nahor. That relative stuff is very, very complicated, but it's there if you really care about it and want to dig it out. We go to Genesis 24, verses 16 through 19. The girl was very beautiful. This is Rebekah. A virgin, and no man had had relations with her, and she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, that's Eliezer, and said, please let me drink a little water from your jar. She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking. When she says quickly lowered her jar to her hand, she probably took it off her head and put it down to her head and hand and then gave Eliezer some water. Notice she was very beautiful, just like Sarah was. Notice the scripture is not like modern people who won't call a girl beautiful for fear that will be saying the girl is dumb. No, she was beautiful. Nothing contradictory about being beautiful and smart, as well as courteous and humane and kind and all the other good qualities that I'm sure Rebekah had. Now, verse 16 says that Rebekah came up to the well. The well probably had a descent and an ascent to it. So she comes up and she saw Eliezer, and she might well have thought, well, you've got 10 camels and plenty of pots. Why don't you draw your own water? But she nevertheless gave him water from her jar. But I wonder what she was thinking. Maybe she's thinking, oh, this old man, he's tired. Can't dip the jar into the water. But at any rate, in verse 18, she calls him Lord. She says, drink, my Lord. Very formal, very honorable title. She might have observed his large retinue of camels, as John Gill points out, and figures this guy must be a big shot from somewhere. We go to Genesis 24, verses 20 through 22. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her wrist weighing 10 shekels in gold. Now, it was actually a nose ring. He gave Rebekah a nose ring. NASB just has a ring. The King James has an earring. But actually, the Hebrew, according to NIV, Adam Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, and Ellicott, four commentators say it's a nose ring, so I'm assuming it's one of those. John Gill says it could be a nose ring in one of the nostrils, or it could be a ring that hangs down from the forehead on lace or ribbon and resting on the nose, that kind of nose ring. I don't know. I never have thought nose rings were particularly attractive. The ring hanging down with a piece of lace from the forehead resting on the nose. That sounds pretty beautiful. But again, that's a cultural thing. So he gives her a gold ring weighing a half shekel. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about a shekel. Though not in the Hebrew, the word is correctly supplied here as the most common unit of weight in ancient times. Originally, the shekel was only a weight, not a coin, since coinage was not invented until the 7th century B.C. That was in Lydia, I think it was, in Asia Minor. Adam Clark says on the subject of ancient weights and measures, very little that is satisfactory is known. Well, we can just assume that it was a nice gold ring, two bracelets for wrist weighing 10 shekels and gold bracelets. Now, this is a handsome present, suitable for a virgin, John Gill says, but this is what I'm thinking. What in the world is Rebekah thinking? Here's a strange man, an old man, out of the blue, offers her valuable presents. She must have figured there was a marriage deal being proposed here somewhere. She must have figured something's going on. We go now to Genesis 24, verses 23 and 24 and 25. Eliezer continues and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again, she said to him, "We have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in." Now, why did Eliezer ask, "Is there room for us?" And the "us" is probably referring to him and his camels. Why is there room to lodge in your father's house? Well, here's some options. One option that would explain why he asked this is that Eliezer would then know whether the girl's family was wealthy enough for Abraham. Now, I wonder about that. Why would it matter to Abraham if Rebekah was wealthy or not? I don't think he would care that much. I think the better option is that Eliezer could negotiate better with Rebekah's father if he was there on the premises. So that's why he wanted to stay there. The "us" probably refers to Eliezer and his camels. The reason I say that is because Rebekah answers him, says, "We have plenty of both straw and feed. That takes care of the camels, and room to lodge in. That would take care of Eliezer." I'm not going to go through the relations here again. Well, yes, I will, real quick. "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah." Milcah, remember, is the daughter of Abraham's older brother Haran and the niece of Nahor, Abraham's younger brother. At any rate, she confirms to Eliezer this is from Abraham's family, which, again, is exactly who he's looking for. Because Abraham said, "Go to my relatives and find me a wife for Isaac," and there they are. And so God answered the sign, gave him a sign, and there it was. Now, it does seem strange to me that Rebekah would invite a strange man to stay at her folks' house, but I suspect that's because of my cultural biases. It could be that Eastern hospitality would not find this strange at all. You find a strange man, especially somebody with 10 camels loaded with a bunch of gifts, a bunch of goods. He's apparently fairly important, and so, yeah, and he's a stranger, so let's put him up. I don't think that would be unusual. And I'm sure that somewhere in the conversation, although it's not recorded, that Eliezer probably told Rebekah, "I've come from Abraham, your great-granduncle." And also the presents might have had something to do with Rebekah's attitude, too. Well, he's loaded, and he's got a lot of presents. Maybe he wants to give some to me. Maybe he wants to... Maybe my ship has come in. Maybe he's got a husband for me. So maybe it's not so strange as it might appear at first. We go now to Genesis 24, verses 26 through 28, and we'll finish up this audio. "Then the man," that's the servant, "Eliezer, bowed low and worshipped the Lord. He said, 'Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers.' Then the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things." Well, I just finished saying that Eliezer probably told Rebekah about his relationship to Abraham and the fact that Rebekah was in Abraham's family. And it looks like right here in the next verses, he actually did that. At least he implied it. He prayed that way. And I'm assuming that Rebekah heard his prayer. She just stood there and watched him, I guess. And then, because in verse 28, after the prayer, then she runs and tells her mother's household about these things. So she probably knows now that this is a man from her relatives, and ooh, we know what that might mean. So she's probably running to her mother's household because she's thinking, "I'm about to get hitched." Abraham tells the Lord, "The Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers." The NIV has "my master's relatives." The house of his master's brothers, how does that work? Well, Nahor was Abraham's brother, and Nahor married Milcah. Milcah had Bethuel, and Bethuel had Rebekah. So Rebekah is in the house of Nahor, who is Abraham's brother. Now she ran to the household. Probably she's running because she needs to give the household some advance notice that this important visitor has come. She says she runs to her mother's household. Why does it say she ran to her mother's house and not her father's house? Well, here's some options. One, her father Bethuel could be dead. Now some people argue that no, he was not dead. He was alive by citing Genesis 24, verse 50. "Then Laban and Bethuel replied, 'The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good.'" So Bethuel, there is a Bethuel alive when Eliezer gets to the house. But there's an argument in favor of Bethuel being dead because this Bethuel was perhaps a younger brother of Laban, not the father of Rebekah and Laban, but a younger brother of Laban, and so it's a different Bethuel. And besides, as Adam Clark points out, the whole business of negotiation seems to be conducted by Rebekah's brothers, Laban and Bethuel would then be a brother helping the negotiations with Laban. If it had been the father involved, it would just be the father conducting the negotiations, but we don't see the father, Bethuel, conducting negotiations. So this Bethuel must have been a brother. I think that's pretty good reasoning to me. Although you could say that maybe Bethuel is still alive, but he's too old to conduct negotiations because he's so old. So maybe he was still alive, but just too old. But at any rate, the negotiations were with the brother, Bethuel. All right, so we're getting back to the options of why she ran to her mother's house and not her father's house. Perhaps her father, Bethuel, is dead. I would say probably he was dead. Also, daughters were freer in that culture to speak with their mothers rather than their fathers, so she went to her mother to tell her, got to get the house ready, the tent ready. And the women had separate tents to themselves back then, and so she would go to her mother's tent and say, we got a visitor coming. In our next audio, we'll discuss the negotiations with Laban as Eliezer tries to get Rebekah for Isaac's wife. We'll do that our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that one, and I hope you enjoyed this one.